Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memory lives in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Good evening and welcome to Blog Talk Radio's scan show, Stop Child Abuse Now, number 2426. NASCA has a single purpose, and that is to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts, and showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second is offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. I am Linda Vitti, an advocate, counselor, and life coach from New Jersey, and I will be your host for this evening. So welcome. We encourage you to call in and be part of our panel. The number to call in is 646-595-2118. Again, that's 646-595-2118. And we welcome all to call. Tonight's special guest is Dr. Kelly Helfy from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, the author of a new book, Men Too, Unspoken Truths About Male Sexual Abuse, which is available through Amazon. Kelly is a speaker and a registered psychologist at Peaks and Valleys Psychology. She began her professional career working in adult youth and corrections, where she noticed a disproportionate number of males in the system. I'm going to stop there with her bio. I'm not going to read the entire thing. I'm just going to introduce her, and I'm going to let her tell her story. So let's introduce Dr. Kelly.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you guys.
Oh, we're really excited about having you on tonight. So I'm not sure, what your background is. I mean, I know what your background is, but I don't know how you want to take this, if you want to start with your experience and go forward to where you are now, or you want to go into your childhood. I'm not sure how you want to proceed.
Yeah, no problem at all. I don't mind giving you a bit of my background. So, Linda, yeah, you mentioned that I started working in corrections. Yes, I worked in a couple of different correctional facilities, both adult and youth. And you're correct, I did have this observation that there was sure a lot of men there compared to women. And that made me very curious. Corrections was something that I sort of used as a stepping stone and then went into policing. So for 13 and a half years, I was a Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which is sort of the equivalent of the FBI here in Canada. and then I took an interest in specializing in sex crimes. And 4 out of the last 5 years of my career, I worked in a unit called the Integrated Child Exploitation Unit. And there I became very familiar with grooming techniques. We would regularly seize material from offenders that we had charged, and we would be required to go through all that material. So there was literally a time period where I was stuck in a room reviewing videos for about 3 months, and I became very familiar with grooming techniques. I also was being trained to be a subject matter expert, so the RCMP was flying me out to Ottawa for different training sessions under a forensic pediatrician, Dr. Sharon Cooper. And she was teaching us about childhood sexual abuse, plus she had guest speakers in, and one of those guest speakers was a pro hockey player who I was familiar with. You may be familiar with him. His name's Sheldon Kennedy. He played for the Boston Bruins, Calgary Flames, Detroit Red Wings. And he came and spoke to us, a group of seasoned sex crimes investigators, about the reasons why he hadn't disclosed his sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. So he was a pro hockey player, and he'd started playing junior hockey around, I think I'm getting that right, junior hockey, around age 15. He started being abused by his coach, Graham James. And so he talked, so he talked to us about the reasons why he hadn't disclosed. And he said things like, you know, my family was, I was raised in poverty and my career was literally lifting my family out of poverty. My parents were super, my parents were super proud of me. The entire community was super proud of me. He knew he had the skills to make it pro, and he knew that his coach had the means to get him there. So he, you know, was reluctant to report his abuse, lest it end his career, right? So, he talked about living, he talked about living this double life, you know. On one hand, he was a pro hockey player, and on the other hand, he was being victimized. And so I could relate to that because, a little bit, I could relate to that because at the time I was being bullied and whatnot in the Mounties, so... You know, I too felt like I was in the top of my career, and that if I said anything about it, I'd lose my career, which in the end I did. So that was sort of how I got interested in working with male survivors of sexual abuse.
Wow, that is very interesting. So did you have a background of sexual abuse before you got into this, before you had your career?
No, not per se. I did, unfortunately, grow up reading my dad's pornography, and, you know, that took its own toll on my self-esteem, just my body image and my idea of love and sex and that kind of stuff, and, you know that came into impact my dating life when I was pretty young, you know, maybe engaging in things that I shouldn't have been because I thought that's how you got love and stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't sexually abused, but I kind of grew up knowing the damage that reading pornography did anyways. So, and
right.
I grew up in
Absolutely.
A pretty dysfunctional, I grew up in a pretty dysfunctional environment. So, you know, I probably would have been diagnosed with childhood developmental PTSD myself. So I kind of knew what it felt like. I knew what it felt like to be traumatized, right?
But then you fit right with us because it doesn't have to be sexual abuse at NASCA. NASCA does neglect, abuse, any kind of childhood trauma.
Yeah.
So you fit right in with the family, I hate to tell you.
No, I knew that. It's just sort of a matter of, I was listening to Bill Murray's his session from last night, you know, and he was talking about not wanting to say too much until his parents were deceased, and I kind of feel the same way, you know. I don't really want to badmouth my parents, you know. Yeah, they're doing better now. They, you know, they did the best they could with what they had.
With what they had, right? Yep.
Yeah.
I hear you. So you know what I'm going to do now? I'm going to bring in the panel and let them see if they have any questions for you so far, and then we'll take it from where you left off. So let me go to my co-host, Joe, in Oregon. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thank you, Linda. Hi, Kelly. Or should I be Dr. Kelly? Sorry.
Oh, that's
Hi, Dr.
fine. No,
Kelly.
Kelly's fine, Joe. Thank you.
Okay. You know, you sort of almost answered the question I had. I was wondering whether the Royal Canadian Mounted Police may have been saved from this male domination type thing. It sounds like it wasn't necessarily.
Go ahead.
No, I'm done.
It's hard to not cut each other off when we're over the phone, right? Yes, it is a very male-dominated career or environment, but I can tell you that I had the worst problems with other females. I know it might be hard to believe, but women can be
really?
Evil. Yes.
Whoa. Oh, my goodness. Wow. Thank you for that. Wow.
I guess I expected it from the men, but I didn't expect it from the women, you know?
Yeah. Were they trying to play the man's game, or were they... I don't know. Who can tell? Anyway, thank you for sharing that, and I look forward to hearing more from you. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks, okay, we're going to go to Mary Ellen in New York. Hi, Mary Ellen.
Hi. Good evening, everyone.
Hello.
Doctor, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I'm interested to hear your story tonight. I appreciate you being here, and thank you for the opportunity. You worked then with people in jails, prisons? I'm not quite sure I understood what your occupation was.
Well, prior to getting into policing, I worked for 2 years in corrections. I did a year and a bit in Lethbridge Correctional Center, which was an adult facility hosting both men and women. And then I worked for, I can't remember, about a year in a youth open custody facility up on Vancouver Island. So I did that, and then while I was working in corrections, I got hired by the Mounties and transitioned into becoming a police officer.
Okay. So then when you were working as corrections, did you mean that that's where you picked up on the fact that there was males who maybe were in due to past trauma?
I don't know that that would be... Go ahead.
Did it influence their lifestyle or something of that sort?
You know what, that's so long ago, I don't really remember if that thought crossed my mind. I imagine that it would have, that, you know, it's not too hard to tell when someone's had a rough life sometimes, right?
Right, right. I'm just wondering, you know, men and women handle things so differently, and maybe that's their outlet was things that got them in trouble.
Yeah, very often is the case. You know, they wind up with emotions that they don't feel that they're allowed to express. So, or they don't feel safe to talk about things. So they bury them, or try to bury them. Maybe even through the use of alcohol or drugs. But unfortunately, when you try to bury anger, it just comes out in different ways.
Right.
Yeah, and drugs and alcohol is always a slippery slope, right? I mean, how do you support those habits,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Yes. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, Mary.
Thanks, Mary Ellen. Okay. So take off where you left off, and I'm curious to hear the rest of your story, how you got where you are.
Okay, sure. I was actually originally planning to become a criminal profiler. You know, when I was young, I was very fascinated by the movie Silence of the Lambs, and I wanted to be Jodie Foster.
Oh, yes.
So it was the only scary movie I ever watched 3 times. And so I positioned myself in the RCMP in the behavioral sciences unit and spoke to the person who was in that position, in the criminal profiling position, and she told me, well, if you want to do my job, you have to go get a master's degree. And as I mentioned earlier, that I was going through bullying and stuff in the RCMP, and my career was not unfolding the way I wanted it to, so I kind of silently went off and started my master's degree. I mean, I just didn't make a big deal about it, that it was for any reason other than, you know, post-career options. But I started taking every course I could in psychology, and then started my master's degree. And, so fast forward a few years, I ended up losing my career to bullying and the PTSD that I developed after it. And I was in a pretty bad place myself, right? I was called Mounteyville, like living in a neighborhood surrounded by my bosses and other police officers. And so I didn't leave my house very often. Yeah, it was pretty gross. So I didn't leave my house very often. And I always say that I wasn't suicidal, but I certainly understood why people are. So yeah, I was, I mean, it's literally what brought me to my knees. I was like, God, if you're real, I need you. And please give me something to be passionate about. And honestly, a few days later, one of my professors at school, like I could see my, literally the doors were closing around me. And I mean, it's just like the writing was on the wall, you know, it was ending. And so I was really scared. I mean, I had a $300,000 mortgage by myself in a big city, and I didn't have any other skills in my own mind other than policing. And I was like, I was proud to be a Mountie, and I was proud to be doing the work I was doing. And I was like, God, no offense to waitresses, but I can't go back to waitressing. Like, this just won't fulfill me now that I've done this, you know? And it was like, right. One of my professors mentioned that he worked at this place called the BC Society for Male Survivors of Sexual Abuse. And I remembered Sheldon Kennedy's lecture, and it was like a little light of hope just turned on in me. And I was like, because I remembered thinking, man, society has failed you. There are no resources for men, right? Mm. And I remember thinking, wow, I could make a difference. Like, I could really get on board to make a difference for male survivors of sexual abuse. And yeah, so I made the decision.
Prayer answered. Prayer answered.
Yeah, absolutely.
I said prayer answered.
100%, yep. So I made the decision to go to Key. I wasn't quite ready to be at work full-time. I was still feeling pretty broken myself. So I said, well, school is a good place to hide, you know. I applied for my PhD. It's crazy.
And,
another prayer answer. God, if you want me to go, open those doors. And so ended up at U of A researching why boys and men don't disclose sexual abuse.
Wow.
And
that
so, yeah,
so
and
cool.
Then a couple years later, turned it into a book.
That is awesome. Wow. You couldn't have unfolded that any better if you planned it, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I always say the only thing, if I'd have known how it was going to turn out, the only thing I'd do different would be to trust more and cry less.
The after lesson.
Yeah, they're good sometimes, aren't they? Thank you, yeah.
That's incredible. Tell us about your book. Tell us about your book.
Okay, so my book is based on my doctoral research. So it's, you know, it's meant as a psychoeducational book, meant to support male survivors themselves, to help them understand their own traumas, how they became victims of sexual abuse, to develop self-compassion for themselves, you know, because men often blame themselves. They often treat themselves as if they knew then what they know now, and that's just not the case. So just I explain, like, trauma, the body's responses to trauma, you know, the fact that arousal when you're being touched is normal. I give 13 stories of different instances where boys and men were abused, how it came about, and, you know, why they didn't say anything. And it's also meant as a psychoeducational piece just for the lay public and professionals, because I know it's kind of funny because, you know, when I was writing the book, they were like, who's your target audience? And I was like, well, everybody. They didn't like that, but it is really, I mean, it's meant for professionals and lay public as well, because most people don't believe that male sexual abuse happens near as frequently as it does. So I thought, okay, I'm going to give you a bunch
Absolutely.
Of examples so that you can start to see it, you know? So,
right,
yeah,
right.
I talk about how trauma can manifest in a child's behavior in the classroom, you know, falling asleep, being the class clown, being disruptive, that kind of stuff, avoiding, isolating, being the odd kid, you know, talk about things like that, just to sort of create awareness.
As you said that, it's so odd, but as you said that, as you just said about the kids in the classroom, I thought of a kid in middle school who acted out, acted weird, and look, now that I know and do what I do, I haven't thought about this person for almost, I don't know, 45 years, and now you just said that, and I'm thinking that kid absolutely was.
And you know what, Linda, that's exactly the purpose of my book. I want people to start thinking. I want people to start thinking outside their normal box. You know, I had another interview this morning for one of our local radio stations, and the interviewer said, I don't know if I want to read your book. I don't want this to happen in my world. And I'm like, it's already happening. You just need to be aware of it.
Because your eyes are closed doesn't mean it's not there.
Exactly, right? I know. We call it, I said to him, well, we call that willful blindness in our world.
Right, exactly. All right, so I'm going to go back to the panel again and see what their input is. Let's go to my co-host, Joe. Oh, hit the mic. There you go, Joe.
Thank you. What you were just talking about reminded me of the same thing I was hearing when I was working with someone trying to convince parents to let their kids learn about how to identify parts of their body so that they're a little more comfortable and what parts aren't touchable and that kind of thing. And they said, oh, I don't want that. No, I don't want anything to happen to my kid. I said, well, we're trying to prevent anything to happen to your kid. But anyway, I hadn't thought about men having signs or you know, of that. I guess for me, for women, it comes out as shyness or trying to, well, for me, it was being overweight. I just wanted to be overweight. And that kind of thing. So how did you do your research? How did you get into the head of a guy to do this?
Well, I went to a trauma conference and put up a poster and said, hey, who wants to talk about their experience of being sexually abused? And it was quite, you know, it was a good idea. It was something I ran by my supervisor, and she said, yes, go. And so I went, and yeah, I mean, I was so busy that one weekend, I ended up with almost all of my data in one weekend. So this was at a conference where men were wanting to talk, you know, where men were expecting to talk about that subject. And they were wanting to talk about it. So, and I mean, I'm also like a trained interviewer, trained investigator. So I kind of knew where to dig when they started talking. And I wasn't really afraid to ask some of those tough questions. And they were more than willing to be cooperative because they knew what I was trying to do, right? They knew I wanted to teach people.
Oh, how cool. Wow. That is great.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Joe, I just wanted to comment about what you said about parents not wanting to talk to their kids about it, right? If they don't talk to their kids about it, kids learn that that is a taboo subject that they can't talk about. So if something bad does happen, they're too afraid. That's what several of my participants said, that, you know, sex was a taboo topic in my house. I couldn't tell my mom that I was abused by her friend.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, maybe that's a comeback I could take for, you know, next time we run into that kind of a response. I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
The research shows that one out of every six males is sexually abused to some extent before the age of 16.
Wow. That's,
You mentioned you put on your body armor, a suitcase, so that people wouldn't find you attractive or that you could protect yourself, right? I mean, boys do the same thing, and
they do
a lot of other plus they do a lot of other things. They engage in hypermasculinity, right? Excessive weightlifting, martial arts, become workaholics, isolate, become asexual, all kinds of things they do.
Yeah. It took me a long time to get over that, my weight thing. I kept yo-yoing, but then I realized what it was about. Thank you so much. I look forward to hearing some more. You have a lot of information. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Joe. Okay, Mary Ellen in New York.
I don't really have any questions right now. I'm just going to continue to listen, but I'm fascinated by everything you've shared. So, I'm anxious to hear some more. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mary Ellen. Okay, so you wrote your book, you got your doctorate, and where do you go from there?
Well, this is it. You know, I'm doing some podcasts and had just got some speaking engagements lined up, and then COVID hit. So really just actually one of the things that I'm hoping to do in the not too distant future is develop programs. So I want to develop a program hopefully for the churches so that some of the men within the church can heal from their own abuse. Yeah, and also to develop a program for psychologists and counselors to, you know, something where that they could get, like, credit for, CE credits for, so that they can just become more aware. Because one of the things that I heard, like, I lectured a few times at U of A, at my university where I went to, and when, each time I did, the profs both came up to me and said that they'd learned things from my lecture, and that it made them think differently about a few of the clients they were working with. And I guess I've just been engrossed in this environment for so long, it's like you think everybody knows what you know. So I like just sort of sharing this information to teach other people what they don't know. I mean, obviously there's still lots I don't know too, but, you know, to get everybody kind of on the same page, I'm continuing to do my research and then share what I learn with other professionals.
That's wonderful. And do you have a private practice with just male sexual abuse survivors? Is that your sole focus of your practice?
Not my sole focus, but yes, I do specialize in male survivors. I work a lot with a lot of traumatized first responders. I guess because I was one, it's kind of easy for us to relate, and they feel safe coming to talk to me because I was a former first responder. And I wind up with people who've also been through bullying and stuff, but I'm grateful that I'm kind of busy enough that I can kind of take the ones that are male survivors so that I can, you know that they get attention in the areas that they need, or I've got a list of other psychologists in town that I can refer to, and different agencies in Canada and the U.S. that I refer to as well, if they're not from Edmonton. But yeah, I do mostly focus on trauma, and then I also like working with couples. So, you know, I guess maybe because I grew up in such a dysfunctional environment, I just get so much joy out of helping couples learn how to fight properly.
I do too. I get it. I know.
Yeah?
I get that.
Like, hey, what I think she's trying to say is this. Can we try that on and teach them how to talk without screaming at each other and how to ask for what they need, you know?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Let me ask you a question. And you're working with male survivors, and I work with mainly female survivors. Do you find that, I know a lot of the female survivors turn it inward, eating disorders, cutting, you know, those types of things, or even, you know, promiscuity. But the men, at least the ones that I've experienced, tend to, with their anger, go outward. Is that your experience as well?
I've seen both, to be honest. I worked at a place called the BC Society for Male Survivors of Sexual Abuse, as I mentioned earlier. And, I mean, definitely saw the promiscuity, but I also saw the isolation and the eating disorder manifest as well. I found that once you start asking questions about it, you know, there is a lot more disordered eating amongst my clients than not.
The first male survivor I met was actually in an eating disorder center that I was at, and I thought that was a unique thing, but apparently it's not. That's more common than we realize, correct?
Yeah, one of, I don't know how ethical this was, but one of the first clients I worked with in BC had told me he hadn't eaten anything in 3 days. I went and got him my lunch. I mean, part of it was he didn't have money, but he was also, like, willing to eat, but anyway, he started liking my cooking. I started bringing him food because, I mean, I learned his story, right? He was too scared to go sign.
Yes.
I eventually did get him signed up for services and stuff like that, but it didn't happen overnight, right?
Sure. Wow, that's interesting. That's such a unique experience that it's incredible. And we've got a few more people on the panel, so if you don't mind, I'm gonna go to them and see if they have anything they want to say or add.
Sure.
First, let me go to Bill in Florida, our CEO. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you very much for running a good show here tonight, and thank you, Kelly, for being here. We really appreciate it. I've been listening since the beginning of the show, and I was watching to see if we're going to get additional participation. And, you know, I have a whole bunch of topics that we might get into here eventually. But first of all, I wanted a male voice on the show, so I called in since we didn't have one yet. To verify, you know, an awful lot of what's been said, for example, the last thing that was the last topic that's come up, I personally don't feel there's a lot of difference between male survivors and female survivors. I mean, we manifest in different ways, sure, and perhaps to a degree more of this and a little less of that, but frankly, we have the same capacity. Like, for example, women have the capacity to be violent, and indeed are. Maybe they express
Absolutely.
It in a different way,
yep.
but they are. And men, as you say, have the ability to be introverts, and they are. There's plenty. So I don't buy that there's this big distinction in, you know, in the groups. Now, what there is a big distinction is what Kelly was saying before. There has been very little help, at least there was in the past, very little help for men if they need to feel they need to identify with men. Now, here at NASCA, we don't do that. But, you know, 1 in 6 and male survivor was about all there was that I could find. And I didn't want to be just with men because I was already so long in recovery. I understood this was a universal experience. People of every kind of background and, you know, every walk of life. So NASCA incorporated that in that sense, everybody and all kinds of abuse and, frankly, all kinds of recovery. You know, so we're a very accepting, group of people who the only requirement for membership, as I've said before, is a desire to recover. That's it. You know, from childhood trauma, no matter what kind, you know. So the one thing I want to bring up is that with a tremendous amount of law enforcement background, and I have some too, a significant amount, although mine was never as a sworn, I was never sworn. I was always a volunteer employee of LAPD and the sheriff's departments and stuff. A lot of experience. I want to, talk a little bit tonight, I hope we will, about some of the frustrations that happen in law enforcement circles when they're asked to do some of the work we're talking about. I know it's a little bit outside the purview of NASCA, which we don't try to bring in outside issues, but it is important when we have somebody with a professional background to at least shed a little light on the fact that we're hearing, for example, that we need a big shakeup in police departments. We need them disassembled and all this, which I don't believe, and I don't think you would believe either. But you certainly need them rearranged. That's the point. And there's an awful lot that goes on in law enforcement these days that never was intended to be law enforcement stuff, perhaps including working with victims. You know, I mean, up to a point, sure, you have to respond to the call and you have to deal with the call. But then, you know, cops are not social workers. You know,
absolutely.
And there should be some method of bringing in the correct kind of trained forces, whether you're talking about child abuse or any other thing, because we need the cops back out on the streets to do public safety, basically. But that's just my, I don't want to get too far into this topic, but I think it's beneficial, Linda, to have somebody, you know, just touch on these things when they have, such a tremendous background in such a thing as, you know, law enforcement. So, of course, we're going to key on more on survivorship, absolutely, which is a whole second career for you if you want.
The first career
is significant.
Yeah, and Bill, you know, if we don't get to it tonight, you can have me back because I was listening to your podcast today and I'm sure you and I could talk for hours.
I'm sure.
I agree with what you were saying about, like, you know, for example, you know, not so many differences between men and women as victims. Yes, absolutely. That's one thing that I really like to advocate is that boys and men are built with the same emotions as girls and women, right? Like, we all have access.
Amen.
We all have those emotions, and we should have access to them. The problem is we as women and society stifle these emotions in men, and we encourage men to stifle themselves, right? So I want to do a podcast just on that someday. But I love, Bill, I love hearing from you that, you know, that you wanted to have a woman's voice in the scene, or that you didn't just want to be speaking with men, because that, you know, that was sort of one of my fears getting out in this, is like, clearly I'm not a male survivor, but I do really have a passion for working in this field. So it's really great to hear that you're welcoming of that.
We actually have what we call hyphenates who join our group to lead some of the shows. They're like question and answer style shows. And Joe actually is keeping track of people that might be interested in doing that. So if it's okay with you, I'll ask her to put your name down. But all you do is we present a kind of a shortened version of the bio that you had tonight. And your background as a hyphenate would be as a survivor hyphen, you know, a police officer or law enforcement, plus therapy, plus psychologist. So you have a lot to offer. And
thank you.
I think one of the benefits of, one of the benefits in our recovery is the ability to share our own stories, which is a gift to anybody we can share it to. That's how I look at it.
Absolutely.
And I can hear that you have that gift, and we'd love to take advantage of it, frankly.
Well, you don't have to take advantage of it. It's my pleasure. And, you know, that was one of the things that I heard a few times when I was doing my research, was that it was a real honor and that it was a very healing experience for them to be able to know that they were contributing to something like my book, like my research, right? Like, they were very grateful to know that, you know, their experience could help ease the pain of someone else's experience.
I totally agree. I have thought for many, many years now about the things that I thought were the worst about me, especially the stuff that happened to me in childhood and all the abuses and stuff, turned out to be my gift.
I heard you say that
today. Exactly what I have to offer somebody else. So,
okay.
I may have said it the first show I ever did. I don't know. I think what you heard was the sample show I did, episode 63, and we're now up to over 3,000 episodes combined with,
Oh, wow.
So,
okay, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Joe will write your name down. We may get in touch with you to explain this. It's not a big deal. And right now, I think our plate is full, but that can change at any time. Somebody has a sickness or a death in the family, and we need a fill-in. And that's how we'd start you off anyway. But we'd be there to help you. So anyway.
Okay.
Linda, thank you for letting me babble a little bit. And I hope other people that are listening will call in. This gal has a lot to offer. A lot to offer. Our NASCA family. And thanks for letting me share, guys.
Absolutely. Thanks, Bill. And yeah, Kelly, you verbalized that perfectly. And I think that's what I was trying to say before, is society has women turning it inward because that's society. And men are kind of, they're pushed in a direction, and women are pushed in a direction that if we were left to our own devices, we'd be very similar. If it wasn't for the outside influences.
Right. And, you know, I think underlying some of that, Linda, is this fear that if we allow men to be vulnerable, and if we acknowledge that boys and men are victims too, that they're not going to be the men that we need them to be. And that's just not the case, right? Like,
this
so often with the men that I work with, right? Like, I mean, they go through a trauma, they need to process this trauma, they process this trauma, and they truly come out even stronger from having faced their fear. One of my favorite quotes of all time is by, I don't know if you know Lisa Bevere. She was here in Edmonton at a conference.
Love her.
Yeah, and she said, when you are forced to face your worst fears, you become fearless. And I said, oh my gosh, you just made sense the last 10 years of my life. Right?
Absolutely.
We become fearless.
That's
when
awesome.
We're forced to face our worst fears. Yeah.
Beautiful. I love her. Let me go to Anne in California. She hasn't spoken yet. Hi, Anne.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yes.
I'm sorry. So, The way that I'm approaching, I guess, being a panelist today is the fact that as a survivor, my method, I guess, inadvertently is through I guess, the prevention and reduction of membership of those with NASCA.
Uh-huh.
And what I mean by that is I work currently caring for children.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how you get help in a failed system that professionals in the system don't recognize it. They don't know how to look for trauma or the accommodation of the assault and how it looks like in children, and end up actually facilitating the abuse by doing so. And then there's a separate question about interacting with a child, but I guess that first.
Sorry, I'm not 100% clear on your question. Was it how do I navigate in this when other professionals are missing it, or how, what was your question exactly?
If interacting with the system, authorities and whatnot, and you look at, say, local law enforcement and social services, they don't even know what to look for and dismiss the abuse immediately without any thorough investigation whatsoever, because they in their mind culturally think that they know what it looks like,
mm-hmm.
to be abused, and especially with young boys who outwardly show, you know, ADHD-ness or just rough housing or things like that, when if you sit down and they're disclosing intimate details and then saying, hey, you can't really talk about this with other people, they're supposed to put on a tough face. And so how do you get help from professionals in a system that constantly fails because their training doesn't detect trauma? It doesn't detect the behaviors, especially of young boys and actually just children that are taught to say that this is a normal part of their life and that these are the things that you hide and these are the things that you don't hide.
Yeah, I mean, and there's so much that you said there in that statement. You know, you're bang on that trauma is often misdiagnosed, whether it's in this classroom or in the police department. You know, oftentimes when victims are questioned, they might, I'm reading right now that, you know, victims might present as, you know, they might, a police officer might, for example, think they're lying when really they're just, you know, dissociating or something like that, right? Like, because they're,
right.
You know, afraid to answer a question or something like that. Or maybe, you know, when I was a police lady, I worked with a female that had been sexually abused by her brother-in-law multiple times. She actually bore 3 children from this guy. And I asked her why she'd never reported it before, and she said she'd tried, but that she was so traumatized by the presence of this male police officer who was so aggressive with her that she just never, ever gave him a statement. I mean, I used to go to this lady's house for tea for about 2 or 3 weeks before she ever gave me a statement, because I knew she was so traumatized by her experience with the police. So how do we work with that? Yeah, I mean, it's a work in progress. That is definitely one of my many goals, is to try and do more education with the police departments and stuff around, A, recognizing trauma, and B, like, how to better care for trauma, you know, victims. One of the things that, I don't know if it's the same in the States, but, and, you know, this is years ago, but when I was a Mountie, I remember I had a person saying that they'd recovered memories of their abuse, and I took it to my boss, and he said, oh yeah, don't even take a statement from her. It's, we can't, you know, we know nothing about that, right? Or we don't support that, right? Well, now, you know, thanks to the research of people like Bessel van der Kolk, we know that that's the body's response to extreme trauma is to bury the memories, right? So now we know that we don't need to discount those types of memory. You know, it might be another challenge to make it stand up in court, but certainly to support the victims in that process is important. I mean, we're a long ways away from being perfect, that's for sure. And I think the, you know, the answer to that is education, is awareness. Like, knowledge is power. If we can come to understand the reasons boys and men don't disclose, the reasons they're afraid to talk about it, the body's response to fear, those kinds of things, this is all going to be helpful for people.
Absolutely.
I hope that answered your question.
Well, I can talk. Let me try a little bit here. On behalf of NASCA, because she did bring up, she hopes that we have less clientele. So do we.
Yeah,
we,
no kidding.
We recognize we're not here to end child abuse. We're not going to – that's ridiculous as a goal in today's world. Maybe someday, way, way, way down the road. But right now, we're trying to reduce the statistics. We're trying to chip away at it. We recognize and appreciate what Ann is saying. And Ann, you're still on the line here, so you can respond to me. But, for example, we have on our recovery page, I think it is, or a resources page, one of those two, a list of things to look for kids that are indicators of childhood traumas maybe going on. So they're usually attitudes and performances and stuff like that. And they're a little different in young kids and a little different in old kids. So we have them in both categories. Then, too, we advocate all the time that people don't waste their time with, for example, a psychologist who is not trauma trained. That's a specific thing now. It wasn't in years past, but it is now. And fortunately, most of the big psychology departments and universities and so forth are teaching it as a specialty, which we applaud. But, you know, some of the people who are privileged to have a psychology degree and can hang out a shingle are not necessarily trained or don't recognize it. It's just as you're saying. They don't know really what to look for or how to respond to it if they do find it. So trauma-trained or trauma-informed psychologists is what we're looking for. And same with ourselves. We don't work with kids, but we work with a lot of people who work with kids. So we only work with adults. But the adults we work with who work with kids, we can educate. And that's a half of our mission, is to educate the public. And people miss that when they don't – when they read our mission, they'll see it's actually our first priority is to educate the public, including professionals. So we are sensitive to that. We're not foolish enough to think we're going to end child abuse, no, but we'd certainly love to reduce the statistics of child abuse, obviously, someday. And in the meantime, every person who we help is another person that's on their healing journey, and we'll turn around and help 10 others or 100 others someday. And so that's the approach.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Bill. Bill, I appreciate what you say that in the U.S., I presume that universities are training in regards to trauma. One of the things that kind of is a bee in my bonnet is that, you know, I went through the police academy, I did my bachelor's degree, my master's, and my PhD, and nowhere did they talk about child sexual abuse or trauma. Anything that I've learned has been all secondary. You know, I mean, they kind of teach you, they point you in the direction of the experts, but like there's no, in Canada, in none of these places that I went to university have specific courses on child sexual abuse or specific training. I mean, that's why U of A brought me in for a guest speaker.
This is why I'm saying that it's not really appropriate for a police officer to be expected to do this stuff. They're not trained for it. If they were trained for it, that would be a different story. But they're not. So it's kind of silly for us to expect them to do a job they don't know about. And that's what that's part of what Ann's saying, too. And so, you know, I understand the frustration out there. Some of these systems are going to have to be disassembled in some respects, and they're going to have some of the jobs we expect them to do now replaced by other services. So I have a feeling we'll see some reduction in funding as long as that funding slides over to sort of social services that are more appropriate for the professionals that deal with social services and not the cop. That's what I think is going to happen.
And just to touch a little bit more on that, you know, your whole goal of prevention, which I think is wonderful. One of my goals is, like, at least to reduce the suicide rates among male survivors, right? Right now that we know that the suicide rate among male survivors is 14 times that of the general population. And you know, males who have not been sexually abused not reporting sexual abuse are, you know, the suicide rate is still 3.5 times higher than females. So to me, there's a correlation there, right? So,
absolutely.
You know, one of the things I talk about in my book is I reference this research out of Iceland called, I can't remember the exact title, but it's like Deep and Unbearable Suffering, Consequences of Childhood Sexual Abuse. and she interviewed 14 Icelandic men who all disclosed that they had lived with profound depression, and each one of them had contemplated suicide or talking about their abuse. So it was either, so they were at the very end of the rope. They were either going to disclose or they're going to kill themselves. So that obviously begs the question, how many people chose the opposite, right?
All I can say is it's a tremendous number, and that the ultimate consequence of childhood trauma is death,
mm-hmm.
most of the time through suicide.
Yeah.
And it happens way more frequently than most people understand. You know, so we don't want childhood trauma to win. I'm sorry, Kelly.
No, it's fine. You're right. Even like Bill, even to just take that, you know, just a tiny bit further, like, you know, thank God childhood suicide is not that common, but a lot of times when there is a suicide in childhood amongst the youth or teen, they don't leave a note. So we don't know why they committed their, suicide.
They're still not disclosing in their death. They're not disclosing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Great show. Thanks, ladies.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for organizing us.
Okay, we're going to go to Joe in Oregon, my lovely co-host.
Thank you. Wow, I like that discussion. That was great. You had mentioned Dr. I keep pronouncing his name, Besselkopf or something.
Bessel van der Kolk. Yeah.
Yes, that book actually saved my life because it said I wasn't really crazy. So that
nice.
You know, it said about the changing of the brain and how
yeah.
you actually have a family in the brain, and that really helped. So I appreciate what you're doing, and I'm actually surprised that there's a similarity between the responses to sexual abuse between men and women, because I can see the difference in the not reporting, but that was interesting, and also that that they would talk so freely to you, and that is such a gift that you have to a non-confronting or non-whatever approach, and I'm sure that they appreciated that. That you were easy to talk to.
Thank you. Joe, you know, you said you were surprised about the differences, but I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's also are about the similarities. There's also mm-hmm. some pretty distinct differences too, which I talk quite explicitly about in my book, that do keep men silent, right? For example, one of the biggest ones is arousal, right? So yes, we know that female victims can get aroused during sexual abuse. God designed our bodies to respond to touch. And even when we're terrified, our brains can send that signal that there's arousal. And the male and the female are both known to have arousal and even orgasm during abuse. Fortunately for women, they can hide that a bit more than men can, right? So this is one of the things that perpetrators use to keep victims silent is like... they'll use their arousal as evidence against them to indicate that they enjoyed the abuse, right? And, of course, the male victim's already confused, right? You know, 90%
yeah.
of abuse occurs by someone that they already know and trust, somebody that they already have feelings for. So they have this relationship where they're, you know, attached to the person, and then the perpetrator escalates it to abuse, and the victim is very confused because they know that they used to like this person or still do like this person, and they know that their body responded to the abuse. So they question whether or not they were actually victims of abuse. Whereas I don't think females question quite as much if they were victims, because it's a lot easier for a woman to not notice her orgasm or to minimize it, whereas, I mean, it's right there front and center for everybody to see if you're a male. And also the perpetrators will distinctively use it against them, right? Oh, look, you have an erection. Look, you ejaculated. You enjoy this just as much as I do. This is wonderful. This is consensual. You love this. And they go away so confused. So that's one of the huge differences that I think happens between males and females when it comes to abuse.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Wow. I appreciate that. I'm learning so much. Thank you.
Let me quickly add one thing, Kelly, to that.
Yeah.
It's obvious that when a woman is violated, when a woman is violated, she has an innie and I have an outie, right? She is entered.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious. She feels completely violated in that. Males have an outie. We have penises, and we get erections, as you say, just because of sometimes thinking we'll do it, but certainly any kind of manipulation, whether it's oral or manual or whatever it is. Almost all of mine was oral, and I certainly ejaculate. The first year I did it, I couldn't ejaculate, but I could have the sensation for the longest time, and it was really enjoyable, I have to admit. Yeah. As an 11-year-old, I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, exactly.
It scared me, but at the same time, it was thrilling, too. So there's some guilt attached to the fact that the male experience, both can be aroused, absolutely. This is where they're similar. Where they're different is in the degree. It's only a matter of degree, to answer Joe's query. It's not that this, both can be stimulated, but the degree. And the male response is also attached to the fear of homosexuality. It certainly was for me. Mm-hmm. Does this mean I'm gay?
Absolutely.
I was terrified of that. And I did not want to be gay. I never was attracted to men, but it was a huge fear. And maybe women don't have that same response. What they'll have is a response to hating all men. It's kind of similar. I hated all men too, if they were gay. I didn't know the difference. And so in recovery, I discovered that there's plenty of homosexuals who are not pedophiles, and there's plenty of pedophiles who are not homosexuals. I didn't know that, so I was educated. So it's, again, a lot of education that needs to go on to get this kind of phenomenon explained and straight.
That's such a good point, Bill. You know, I've never heard anybody describe it quite like that, but that, you know, you're in females are insies and males are outsies, right? Yes, I mean, you're right. It's so obvious that when something's put inside of you that you're violated, but it does come off, or it may be perceived as being more consensual because it's a outer stimulation, right? I didn't force you. You allowed me to do this kind of thing, right? And the confusion that, of course, I think anybody in the world would agree that an orgasm feels good, right? But of course, when you're 11, you don't understand, you don't make meaning of it until later on in life when you come to understand sexual experiences, right? And then, you know, especially for a boy who comes to understand they had their first sexual experience with either father or their brother or their cousin or their sister or babysitter or somebody so much older than them, and then they make this meaning of it, and that's when it becomes, that's when the trauma kind of manifests for them, when they realize, when they make sense of what happened. Not so much, not always during the experience, but later on in life, they come to understand it
later,
as their trauma. Yeah.
I didn't even know what the word sex meant. I had never heard the word sex. So I was, you know, trapped with this guy for a month. And when the month was over, school started. And I learned, quote, with quotes around it, whatever I learned originally from the playground. And it was horrible.
Yeah.
So I didn't learn anything accurate there. But I was even more confused and more terrified. Because that's where I heard about, you know, you don't want to be called a faggot, you know, or gay or whatever. They didn't even use the word gay back then, but whatever they used.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what any of this meant. So, again, educating our kids as early as we possibly can is the best deterrent, frankly.
Absolutely.
And we don't do enough of it. We do not do enough of it. And that's another thing NASCA is, posed to advocate for.
That's awesome. I've made a list of references that I refer people to, and yours is on there now, and I will also be checking out your recovery page. It sounds like there's some really great resources there.
That's great. It's there for you to use in any way you want.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, we're going to go to Mary Ellen in New York. Hi, Mary Ellen. Sorry to keep you on hold for so long.
Oh, no, no problem. I've enjoyed listening to learning a lot. I was just thinking from the difference since I was a child living in my small town and now that I'm older, just in the most recent year, our county has started pushing for education between social services and the other human service agencies in town, in the county, and our police department to learn trauma education, you know, and what to recognize, how to recognize victims and the signs of children. And, you know, so they've been having speakers and trainings, and it's so empowering to see that because it's taken years. So there is change taking place, so we can all be thankful for that.
You're right. Change is slow to come. I wish everybody would be getting on board a lot faster.
Well, maybe it'll be this big domino effect. And like Bill said, with everything that's going on in society right now, there could be major changes in different departments. So let's hope that it does bring this to light.
Absolutely.
Linda,
thanks,
if I may, there.
Sure, go ahead.
If I may, there was one thing that I was kind of hoping to be able to talk about tonight, if that's okay. It's just sort of this, Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I
just
have one more panelist
I
want to go through.
Oh, sure, go ahead. Yeah, for sure.
Yep. Okay, we're going to go to Bailey in Florida. Bailey, you have anything to add?
Well, hi, everybody. I would like Dr. Kelly to say whatever she wanted to say, and then I'll ask my question.
Okay. Thanks, Kelly.
Okay.
All right, take it away, Kelly.
Okay. I've been doing a few of these podcasts over the last couple months, and somebody put me onto this book by Dr. Anna Salter, and it's called Predators, Pedophiles, Rapists, and Other Sex Offenders, Who They Are, How They Operate, and How We Can Protect Ourselves and Our Children. And I'm learning a lot from this book, and I really like what she talks about in her book about how, there's this perception in the general public that, you know, this sort of willful blindness that we all like to think that, oh, well, I would be able to tell who's an offender. I would be able to tell who a predator is.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, isn't that interesting, right? Like, I mean, I think if we were all to really think about it, even myself, I like to think that I can tell who a pedophile is, right? And I mean, I've maybe picked out one or two in my life, but, you know, I mean, they're a lot more common than we think. And I think seeing child molesters as monsters is one of the most harmful things we can do to ourselves, right? Because if we see them as monsters, we are less likely to suspect the people we should be suspecting the most, right? So we have to get over this idea that they look different, right? We have to get this over this idea that we're going to be able to tell. Because, you know, if we stick to that mentality, we are never going to be able to protect our children, right? The people who are offenders are, you know, they put on the facade of niceness. They put on, they work very, very, very hard to maintain this sort of second identity. They live double lives, or as in the general public, they are helpers. They are the nicest people you will know. They are the good employee. They are helpful. They're married sometimes. They're fathers. They're kind and gentle. They're hard workers. They're friends. Basically, they will move mountains to get access to children. And if there's any one clue that I think might even be the biggest clue, it'd be like, if it seems too good to be true, it might be too good to be true, right? So this sort of idea that, that we're going to be able to recognize them, we have to be open-minded. And that was really all I wanted to make sure that I got to bring up tonight. I guess one of her quotes was that kids are rarely taken at gunpoint. It's usually through seduction. Isn't that powerful?
Absolutely.
It's going to typically be the person that we refuse to suspect.
And when you say we think we can pick it out, and I was already a counselor, I was already working at a church. Close friend became at the church, big donor, helped everybody, was the most great guy, deacon in the church.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never in a million years would you think we're having family dinners, he's watching the children, and he's abusing the child.
Yeah.
And
we
were blown away.
Yeah.
And I just was like, how could I miss it?
Yeah. But, you know, that is such another good point that I was just thinking about tonight. I was just, like, kind of coming up with blog ideas. And it isn't, you know, like, this idea, not on my watch. Like, my kids were never alone with him. I was always there. It often happens when you're in the same room or the next room. You know, like, just to give an example, I worked with a victim who said that, you know, this fellow was friends with the family, and he would come over and watch movies, and he'd have a blanket over himself and one other kid, and he was abusing that kid underneath the blanket. It right while the parents were there in the same room, or you know, we're all camping, or we're all, you know, it's New Year's and we're sleeping in different beds because there's too many people in the house, and, you know, mom's in the next room and dad's sleeping with, you know, nephew Billy or whatever, right? This is one of the places where it's happening, right? So oftentimes they're right there present when it's going on, and that's such a scary thought, but we just need to have our eyes open that, you know, I just went and warned one of my neighbors, like, yesterday. I was like, I'm seeing this teenage boy befriend your son, and it scares the crap out of me. I said, he goes, oh, I think it's innocent. And I said, well, isn't that nice? I said, I don't. I said, on what planet is, like a teenage boy, you know, befriending a six-year-old boy? Like, why? I said, he has an ulterior motive, period, you know? And there's no reason, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Teenage boys do not want to hang out with little boys unless they have an agenda. Unless your cousins and you're mentoring or something and it's legit, but I don't know. Maybe I'm a little bit biased, but.
No, one of my clients, her cousin, a family friend, was with their daughter in a pool. It was a cousin, a relative, was fondling the 3-year-old underwater in the pool in front of the mother.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that
we don't
realize
this happened.
Absolutely, yeah. That was another thing that I learned, that the most common age of onset is around age 3 for sexual abuse to begin.
Wow.
Lots of interesting stuff in that book. You might want to try have her on your show.
Yeah, right. Oh, gosh. So we have about 20 minutes left. Where would you like, is there anything you want to get in or a point you want to make? And then we'll go to the panel one more time.
No, I think, let's get back to that. I think it was Bill in Florida.
Bailey.
Yeah.
Bailey.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
Okay, Bailey, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Yes, I have two questions. One, can a pedophile ever be cured?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. Now, this is not my area of expertise, but you know, again, reading in this book, I'm learning that, unfortunately, a lot of the programs that are being offered are targeted at working towards impulse control. Unfortunately, these are not impulsive acts. They are predatory, well-thought-out acts. So I think it's a bit of a joke that we're trying to get them to practice impulse control. Can they practice abstinence? Absolutely. I mean, jail's a great deterrent. I don't know. I believe in the power of prayer, and I believe God can change anybody if they're willing. But is our programming working? I'm not so sure about that, right? I'm sorry, that's not my area of expertise, but, you know, I think outside
so
of being...
Would you say that these people are sociopaths?
I don't even think we use that term anymore. I think, psychopaths and sociopaths. I actually, that was a question I had myself.
It's a term we use a lot now, by the
way. That was actually a question I was going to email Dr. Salter to see if she could give me I was trying to look that up in her book today, like what's the percentage of sex offenders that are psychopathic? I'm not sure what the rate is. The key would be, do they have a conscience about what they're doing or not? I'm sorry, I can't answer that either.
Okay. Okay, now I have another question you may not be able to answer either, but I have I'm a survivor of domestic violence, and I have a lot of friends that are in similar situations. And one thing we all have in common, we've come together and realized, is that our ex-spouses were all abused as children. and they never got help. So would you agree that people that have trauma that never get help, once they're adults, and I'm talking about in their 30s, 40s, they become very sick people?
Well, if we're talking specifically about sexual offenders, that's another actually very interesting thing I'm reading in Dr. Salter's book. She was talking about how, you know, most sex offenders, like 70% of sex offenders, will claim that they were abused themselves, which she says is very unreliable data, right? Because isn't it wonderful if we can be empathetic towards them now because they were victims themselves? So she was quoting research about how incarcerated offenders that were being interviewed were the ones that were just interviewed about their own childhood. 70% of them were claiming that they were victimized themselves sexually. However, when they threatened to polygraph them, that number jumped down to 30% or dropped down to 30%. So she was saying, like, I mean, especially the ones that are psychopathic, right? Like the manipulation, like, why would we trust them now? They've been lifetime liars. And how convenient, like, if we empathize against them for being victimized themselves, aren't we going to treat them better? Aren't we going to reduce their sentence? That kind of thing. So research shows that less than 10% of all victims go on to reoffend. Now, I know that that is slightly different in some of the northern indigenous populations where their entire cultures have been decimated from sexual abuse and stuff. But in the general population, less than 10% of victims go on to become offenders. So, you know, you have to kind of keep that in mind that this again is like a nice way for us to, it also helps us in society be comfortable. Oh, well, at least we can explain why these guys are offending against children. They were victims themselves, but that might not be the reality.
Well, I was really referring more to people that have been sexually abused as children that grew up without ever getting help and became unhealthy. Not sexual abusers, but either mentally, physically, violently, husbands or boyfriends. So that's what I was
asking. I think I understand your question, Bailey. As I mentioned earlier, like one of the most common reasons for non-disclosure that I had among my participants when I did my research was, fear. And one of the ways fear manifests itself is memory loss. So in extreme situations where there's extreme child abuse, you know, God designed our bodies so that they will respond in a certain way that if it's unbearable, we put it into lockdown. We aren't even aware of it until later in life. Unfortunately, sometime later in life, when you are safe, when you are in a healthy relationship, when you are feeling supported, that's when these memories come back. I don't know the exact, I can't remember the exact number. I think it was at least half my participants that had memory loss for at least some period of time. Some of it was purposeful, though. Some of them chose to, like, drink away the memories of their abuse and were actually successful temporarily. But the question, to answer your question, are they unhealthy? I would say if they've purposefully stuffed their abuse or if they've purposefully, you know, ignored their abuse, it's more than likely going to manifest in one way or another eventually, right? So like I mentioned earlier, it could be through becoming asexual. I want nothing to do with sex. It was too traumatizing, right? I'm disgusted by the idea, or I'm disgusted by my body, or they develop unhealthy coping mechanisms like alcoholism or drugs, or becoming a workaholic, hypermasculinity. Yes, violence and aggression, for sure. I mean, the one emotion that men have always had permission sort of to display is anger and rage, right? I mean, not that it doesn't get out of hand, but, you know, I mean, in society, we've squashed, traditionally, not so much now, I believe, but in the past, we've squashed men for having any other emotion other than anger. So, you know, I mean, underneath anger is typically hurt and sadness. So if we could just, So,
thank you. I appreciate it. But I heard that I had read somewhere, and I can't remember where, I have to look, that 70% of people in this world have had some sort of trauma in their life as a child. Not necessarily sexual abuse, but some sort of trauma in their life.
Yeah,
so
I want to say I've heard that too.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's where, because you said 70% and then it was taken down to 30%. The other 40% might have not been sexually abused, but...
No, Bailey. She was talking about sexual offenders who have been identified being measured.
Oh.
And when they are not measured with the threat of being on a polygraph, they'll answer to 70%. But when they're threatened by the polygraph, the number reduces to 30%. The other emotion that men are allowed to have, I mean, the other mover and shaker that affects how men's anger is manifested, their feelings are manifested in anger, is, of course, fear. And this whole show's been about fear. We're terrified to teach our kids. We're terrified to talk about when we are abused. We're terrified as an adult to appear too effeminate. So we equate having emotions as being effeminate, which is ridiculous, but that's what we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so right now society is still, you know, hell bent on describing men as machismo or whatever that means. And I never felt that way. You know, I felt broken and hurt and terrified. You know, that's my lexicon of feelings, at least at the beginning.
Okay. But Bill, can I just add to that? You know, that's also the definition of courage that you're displaying right there too, right? You're afraid, you're terrified, yet you're doing it. So you're very courageous. The definition of courage is feel the fear and do it anyway.
Walking through the fear in spite of it.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
I agree.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right, I'm going to go to the rest of the panel now and let them have their final thoughts for the night. So let me go to Anne in California, who's been on hold for 25 minutes. Hi, Anne. Do you have any final thoughts for Kelly?
I am just extremely appreciative of the discussion this evening. Unfortunately or fortunately, the things that you have shared could be in a diary handbook of the things that I've seen unfolding. And so my hope and prayer is that what you know is something that spreads more rapidly than this virus, so that every single person working understands first and foremost these types of practices and what to look for, so that children expressing huge signs of needing help, but in the tiniest whisper, will actually get the help that they need. So just thank you so much. And I hope that somehow there's a way to still know what's going on with the work that you're doing and things like that.
Thank you. Well, you can follow me on my website, kellypalfy.ca, and, you know, I appreciate any shout-outs that you can give, because, you know, I thought this was all going to be over once I wrote a book, that it would be done, but it turns out I got to market it, too. And that's a big job. Hadn't even thought of that.
For Anne and Kelly, too. The list that I referred to of the different things you look for in children that are indicators that sexual abuse might be going on are on our page. It's called, it's the first link under protecting kids. It's prevention and intervention, and it's a 20% down the page. You'll see the list, though, when you go there. It's
perfect.
Under protecting kids, prevention and intervention.
Well, I will definitely look at that and see if there's anything I need to be adding to my own list.
Okay.
Mary Ellen, do you have anything you want to, final thoughts you'd like to add?
I was just thinking when, I don't know, the comment was made, something about men and their relationships, and whether it was because of their past traumas and all, but in my experience, I'm not sure I know females who have been traumatized and do relationships real well. So I think that's something we may both have in common.
Oh, for sure.
And not know how to handle those situations. I think relationships become real tricky when you're a trauma victim. Yeah.
Absolutely, Mary Ellen, and especially depending on the age you were when your abuse occurred, whether or not you've developed what we call self-regulation skills. So if abuse occurs before a child has developed self-regulation skills, they won't learn how to self-regulate unless they're putting a considerable effort into it later in life. And, you know, early trauma experiences develop into what we call our attachment styles, which are different ways of attaching to other adults in romantic relationships. So you're absolutely right. I mean, trauma affects everybody, male, female, no matter what age you are. But more profoundly, the younger it happens before a child has their own sense of self-worth, their own ability to self-regulate, and, you know, their view of the world or their own resources in hand. So definitely a good point.
Yes. Well, thank you. I've enjoyed your show tonight. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mary Ellen. Okay, we're going to go to Joe, my co-host in Oregon.
Ah, thank you. Okay. I'm having a little difficulty with the concept that a pedophile can be born as a pedophile. I'm of the pure birth type thing, except for occasional miswiring of the brain or something. But are there other ways that a pedophile is created, or does it really seem like they're born that way?
Oh my gosh, I wish I knew the answer to that myself.
Okay.
I will speak to, you know, this was actually an issue for me when I was a police officer. You know, there's this attitude out there among even professionals that pornography, even child pornography, is not harmful. Of course it's harmful. Talk about a gateway drug, right? Like, I mean, if you're viewing these images, you're building that desire. So, you know, I can't answer that. I'm sorry, Marilyn, about whether or not they're, sorry, this is Anne, is it? about whether they're born, sorry.
Yeah.
whether they're born that way. But I do think that people can choose to either feed those fantasies or squash them, right? Like, I have heard people say, I am choosing not to be, you know, for example, I've had homosexuals come into my practice that are Christians, and they say, I don't want to engage in homosexual relations, so I am going to choose to be asexual. I'm going to choose abstinence, right? I think any pedophile could choose to do the same, and I suspect many do. But I also suspect that a large number of them are feeding those fantasies, and even if they think it is harmless or that they have no intentions of ever offending, that feeding those fantasies will lead to acting out.
But there's a lot of evidence or whatever that they really cannot be rehabilitated, or at least the techniques that are being used. Let's put it that way. Techniques that are being used to treat them are not working. And it seems like if it's, I don't know, that's just such a confusing thing for me, because I really have this thing about an innocent birth, you know, your innocent birth, and that people aren't really born that way with those, you know, like pedophile or, those kinds of inclinations. So, and for me, they found the gay gene, and that, so it's they are born that way, but they can choose how to express it in themselves out in public, but it's not a disease like pedophilia and stuff. But okay, anyway, thank you. I really learned a lot, and I appreciate you being here, and you're doing great work, and I think it's really helpful, and I'm glad you're here, and good luck on the rest of your work. I think it's going to be great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Bailey, you have any quick final words?
No, yes, I'm going to let her finish.
Can I just ask what social media you're on? Because I could tag you whenever we have a show.
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. You're going to ask me for the names, and I should have them all handy here.
Under Dr. Kelly Palfrey or just Kelly Palfrey?
Oh, just one sec here. I'll get you the names.
He's on LinkedIn under Dr. Kelly Palfrey, and it's linked in the description of tonight's show. So you can
okay,
start
thank
there.
You.
Okay.
And Twitter, yeah. I'm on at Men22020. At Men2. At Men2, T-O-O, 2020. And then Facebook, I am Men2, Unspoken Truths About Male Sexual Abuse, just like my book.
It's under your book name, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, the book name.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
Okay, Bill, you got the final word.
I wanted to remind Joe that I'd really like it if she would get in touch with Kelly to, find out how she, may be able to volunteer with us. We're all volunteers, Kelly, as you know. So Joe is the coordinator
great
of
job.
All our volunteer efforts, which is why she's going to she's probably the one that will get in touch with you, at least initially. And you can go from there with whatever you're interested in. If you have some article you've written that you want to post on the website, we'd love to do that for you and so forth.
Sure.
And your book will stay attached not only to this show, but it'll also go in the list eventually that we're working on of all the SCAN guests, the Stop Child Abuse Now guests who have written books. All your books get listed on a new project that we've just created. We're only halfway through it, so be a little bit patient, but you're going to be listed there too.
I really appreciate that, Bill. I very much appreciate that.
Well, I loved having you here. Wasn't she great, Linda?
Absolutely. I learned a lot. So we have about 3 minutes left. Do you have any final thoughts for the listeners?
I just felt like we kind of might have left that last panelist hanging a little bit. She was asking, thoughts about can pedophiles be cured? And I just want to reiterate that I think God can do anything. And to be honest, I personally see this spiritual thing, I see not so much as a disease, but maybe a bad spirit or something like that that's attached to these people. And, I think I think God can change people, but whether or not we're willing to let him is always another story.
It's the truth. Free will.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess I apologize. I'm often asked questions that are kind of way outside my area of expertise, and that's definitely one of them.
Well, we know that that child abuse has always been with us. It's eons old. It's probably going to last a lot longer, which is why I say it's really not. If we put in our mission statement that we were going to end child abuse, which I see nonprofits doing, I think that's really dishonest. But it is true that we want to reduce the statistics. So whether you believe that it was nurture or nature that created a pedophile, they are here and they're going to continue.
Exactly.
They have not found any significantly effective method of changing someone who has the appetite for sex with kids, for example, at all. They're constantly trying things, all kinds of things. I do believe that you possibly could do it through spiritual means, but you'd have to really work hard. But it's possible. So I don't want to say it's not possible, but as far as, we're not even on the right trajectory yet to decide, what's going to be the virus we could give people to predict, to stop them from having these desires, It's not even close. We have no idea. So thank you again,
Even
though.
Spiritual healing has been grossly abused by the system too, right? But,
Well,
Bill,
exactly.
I think a reasonable goal might be just to make it harder for the pedophiles to have access.
That's true.
Yes,
and the best we've come up with, you said it before, Dr. Kelly, is incarceration. It's frankly separating them from society.
Yeah.
That's the best we've ever come up with. And it doesn't fix anything. It just separates them from kids. And someday they'll get released,
And they've had lots of time to build their fantasy world.
And that's the last thing I want to say is they are us. That's why they look like us. They act like us. They're community people like us. They're solid citizens like us because that's a separate personality that they present to the world so they can go ahead and do their evil deeds, to use your word, behind our backs.
Yeah, the proverbial wolf in sheep's clothing.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, Dr. Kelly, how do you pronounce your last name? Palfy?
Palfy.
Dr. Kelly Palfy from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, the author of the book Men Too, Unspoken Truth About Male Sexual Abuse. We thank you. You were an absolutely phenomenal guest, and we hope to have you back soon. I am Linda Vitti from New Jersey, and good night and God bless.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was gone. You are forgotten after all that you've done. Another tomorrow, that dawn was gone.
Talk Radio.